war. We have no choice. We have to do it with the adversaries we have out there. We have, I call it the super duper missile. And I heard the other night, 17 times faster than what they have right now.
You heard the Commander-in-Chief, Donald Trump, there boasting about his new toy.
It's a sign of how things are getting serious on the geopolitical front, which could indeed spark a new arms race between the world's two great superpowers, China and the US.
The rhetoric is certainly ramping up, and coronavirus may have even intensified the animosity that has been building between the two countries for some time.
But rescuing the economy from coronavirus has also stretched government finances to the limit, and it looks like in many Western countries, spending cuts will be needed. Defence has often found itself on the block at times of distress like these.
Yet worries that the current Cold War may turn into a hot war at some point may protect defence spending from the bureaucrats in Westminster and Washington.
And it may also mean smarter spending on new technology-led warfare, including drones, cyber warfare and even space forces, which you've just heard Donald Trump launching this week.
On this week's Investment Hour, our defence correspondent Nilushi Karunaratne has put together a series of excellent interviews to help outline the changing outlook for the defence sector and what this means for investors, including Malcolm Chalmers, Deputy Director of the Royal United Services Institute.
I think the most likely scenario is the defence budget will get a small real terms increase.
And defence analyst Howard Wheeldon.
I think we will have far more aggressive, positive actions towards spending what we need to do in the future, which will be space-related, it'll be cyber-related.
And Alex Janiu has spoken to Steve Wright, a former Airbus engineer and senior research fellow at the University of West England, to discuss the aerospace side of the industry.
Crucial thing to know about the civil aerospace market, and this is both one of its strengths and its weaknesses, is nothing happens quickly.
I'm Megan Boxall.
And I'm John Heumann. Welcome to the Investment Hour. One of the key questions moving out of this crisis is whether we will see defence cuts moving forward. The government borrowed a lot of money to keep the economy afloat during the peak of the COVID-19 crisis.
As we head towards another downturn, the defence budget could be in the firing line if the government looks to make more savings or prioritise spending elsewhere. To shed some light on the issue, Nilushi spoke to Professor Malcolm Chalmers, Deputy Director of the Royal United Services Institute.
Where I think the defence budget is relatively protected is that the Conservative Party in its manifesto committed to an annual real terms increase of 0.5% in the defence budget. And there's no indication so far that they're about to renege on that commitment. So I think the most likely scenario is the defence budget will get a small real terms increase, which is certainly not as good as some of the more favoured departments like health and policing, but it's not as bad as it has been in some previous reviews.
Can I just ask if there's any comparison to what we saw in the wake of the last recession, how defence spending sort of changed over the past decade, if you like?
Well, in 2010, when the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats came to power in a coalition and had a major post-crisis spending review, the defence budget suffered quite badly. It wasn't the worst hit department, but its budget fell by around 9% in real terms over 5 years. And then in 2015, there was another review after the Conservatives got an overall majority. And broadly speaking, over the next 5 years, 2015 to 2020, the defence budget rose by just under 10%. So more or less got back to where it was in real terms at the beginning of the decade. And now it feels as if it's levelling out. The overall level will be just above inflation. But because inflation is much lower, because the rate of inflation is almost zero now, and there's some possibility it might even become negative, a small real terms increase is also going to be a very small cash increase. And that's going to put some really serious pressure both on the personnel side and on the equipment side, which are the two basic bundles in the defence budget.
We've now been joined by Nilushi. Thanks for that interview. A nice overview of what was going on right now. You mentioned cuts, and in the wake of a huge period of spending, there are going to be some big public sector cuts. Do you think defence is an easy sector to turn to when governments are looking for cuts? Because after many years of peace in the UK, it doesn't seem like a big deal to big parts of the voting population to make cuts in defence.
I mean, in an ideal world, governments would be able to spend as much as they like on whatever they like, but that's obviously not how it works. And particularly in times like these, something's got to give. So you can't take resources away from something like the NHS. Boris Johnson has promised that we're not going to return to austerity. So what's going to go? So I mean, defense is a national priority. That's, you know, an undoubted fact, but it also makes an easy target. When you hear things like the MOD has a potential £13 billion shortfall in its budget, that implies waste and that there are savings to be made. So I'm not really surprised that the defense sector has come on the radar for cuts.
And reading the news feature that you wrote this week, waste in procurement is one of the biggest things that the government is looking at. Something that Boris Johnson's chief advisor, Dominic Cummings, I know is perhaps being thought to be looking at very closely.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bugbear of his, kind of waste in government in general, but particularly the MOD. He's sort of really anti-big, expensive equipment. He thinks we should be going for more sort of modernised, automated drones and things like that. So his role could be key in this review as to what actually happens to defence spending. I mean, even before the coronavirus shock to the economy arrived, the government announced it would be undertaking an integrated review into the UK's security, defence, development and foreign policy. While the pandemic saw the process postponed, it's now back up and running. Alongside a comprehensive spending review, it's likely to have big implications for the UK's defence spending and the wider industry. Here's defence analyst Howard Wealdon with his thoughts on the matter and some other issues that might crop up.
It is an integrated review. It is about defence, it is about security, and it is also about Foreign Office policy. So it is very different than the ones that have gone before. And you could say that all defence and security reviews should be based on foreign policy, but clearly in the past they haven't. Do I think this upcoming one will be any different than those that have gone before? Probably deep down I don't, but at least they're going to have a try, and they're looking at what all three working together, that's Home Office, Foreign Office and MOD, need to do to work better together and to make the whole thing more efficient. And of course, we mustn't forget that within all this is international development spending, because that's been thrown into the Foreign Office pot as well. When you get the results of this review at the end of this year or beginning of next year, I'm not quite sure on the final timing of this, to be quite honest. But obviously, it's being led by Dominic Cummings in brackets. He's there and he will push forward what he wants. What sort of differences do I think it will make? I think we will have far more aggressive, positive actions towards spending and what we need to do in the future, which will be space related, it'll be cyber related, all sorts of way things that we've been thinking about and we've already started. But the future is about autonomous systems. The future is about a very, very different attitude and approach to how we spend our money on defence than it was before. You know, clearly, the big factors in this, in terms of cuts, will be first of all the army in terms of personnel numbers, bases. The army have got bases dotted around everywhere. They need to be made to be more efficient. Of course, the Navy has got to find ways of funding what it's doing. And I think inevitably we will see a reduction in the number of surface ships, not necessarily capital ships out of the existing plan. In other words, I think we will ultimately aim to retain 19 capital ships. But in the meantime, before we've got the new Type 26s and the Type 31s, neither of which program I think will be impacted by defence cuts, we might go down before we go back up again. So the Navy's got to find new ways of doing things and, again, making itself more efficient.
You've mentioned Dominic Cummings. Much has been made of his involvement in the process. Do you think he's a somewhat new variable for these reviews compared to previous reviews we've had?
Well, there always seems to be somebody that pops out of the woodwork and has things to say. I mean, if I go back to SDSR 2010, that relied on the senior civil servants who didn't necessarily understand defence, combining with the academic organisations who always have a firm belief. They're there to test and they're there to challenge, but I think they challenged a bit too far and they pushed capability that we required down to a level which was through their recommendations, which was actually turned out to be not acceptable. Dominic Cummings is, you know, we would have elected government with a large majority. Defence, as I've said earlier, is a political choice. Defence used to be the number two priority of government. It should be the number one, two priority government, but it clearly isn't. because it's a long time since we've been at war. We've got adversaries and they're increasing. We have issues. There are geopolitical issues emerging all over the world. It's going to get worse rather than better in my view. But Dominic Cummings has come in. He's got to try and save money. Cut the funding. He's got to make sure that it's spent more wisely. I was very, very pleased when I read, and a lot of people condemned it, but I was very pleased when I saw that he was actually going to go out to various army and navy and Royal Air Force bases to actually understand what they actually do. Because unless you understand what they do, how on earth can you improve or cut them? So that is pleasing.
One of Dominic Cummings' criticisms is that the MOD tends to commission what he considers overpriced bespoke kit rather than buying things off the shelf. In your opinion, is that a fair criticism?
It's a fair criticism, but we know sovereign capability is hugely important. It's vital to a nation like ours. We're arguably the sixth largest economy in the world. You know, we should be able to afford and to make the things that we need. Not everything. We can't be all things to all men, but we should be able to produce submarines. We should be able to produce ships. I think when we come back to this, those accusations you mentioned, of course, they're talking about carriers. Just one example, and the carrier was over budget in the end, but they're brilliant. And why was it over budget? In part, it's because the MOD changed things. Remember SDSR 2010 decided that we wouldn't have the Stovall aircraft, the Joint Strike Fighter Stovall aircraft. Well, we would put cats and traps on the carriers. Well, that was an extra £1 billion if we were going to do it, and that delayed the project. It caused a lot of extra money to be spent, only for us to reverse back to the original Labour government decision of buying Stovall, the B variant. It's failed in many respects, but it's a lot better. Procurement is a lot better today than it ever was in the past.
Obviously, this review has to look forward, but 2020 is sort of a year where a few big events are converging, like Brexit, like the US general election. How much do those types of things factor into the decision-making here?
Zero. I would say absolutely zero. The point is, defence is a long-term game. So in the last review, we were talking about Future Force 2025. Now we'll be talking about Future Force 2030. That's 10 years away. So because defence requires that amount of time to organise itself to provide what it is we need. We buy, of course, a lot of equipment from America, as we're seeing with the P-8s are coming into service now, and the E-7 as well, replacing our Sentry aircraft. We'll lose Sentinel, I think, in the next round of defence cuts, because that decision was really taken in 2015. So it's just an extension of that. But you know, big things are happening, but some of them relate to what were decisions that were taken in 2015, and the actions of that happened between 2020 and 2025. I don't think Brexit makes any difference whatsoever. One caveat I would make from that is, I think we've seen a watering down in terms of EU attitudes towards what they can afford to spend on a European defence. I don't want to see NATO damaged in any shape or form by what the rest of the EU does at the moment. I think because of what's happened over the past 6 months, particularly COVID and Brexit, because obviously the EU is losing a lot of funding from the UK. There's been somewhat a backtracking in terms of what the Europeans, what the continental Europeans want to do on their own. But Brexit doesn't make any difference at all.
What about the changed role of the US on the global stage under Donald Trump? Obviously, we've seen increased tensions with China. We've sort of seen his attitudes towards NATO. But obviously, these reviews take a longer term vision, as you've said. How does that sort of thing factor in?
Well, I think he certainly rattled the cage on NATO. He's forced NATO to look at itself and indeed reconsider its longer term future in the sense of how it's funded. America is clearly not going to continue paying the highest burden of NATO costs. So all member countries will have to pay an increased cost, and I think that will. I take that for granted. In terms of U.S. foreign policy, well, the one thing about U.S. foreign policy is we get asked to support it. We don't have to support it. And there will be instances of that going back through history. We didn't support. We went against what they did in Vietnam, but we didn't actually support it. We had no active involvement in Vietnam. And there will be decisions made like that again. And again, part of the thing that will come out of this review is processes. Where do we want to be in the world? What is it we want to do? What can we afford to do? What can we afford not to do? We must always, if any NATO member country is threatened, we must always be there to support it. That's why our people are in Lithuania and Estonia and other places, supporting them, supporting their freedoms.
To pick up on Tempest, is that the sort of direction you think we'll move more in? Because it's sort of a collaborative attempt and there'll be a larger market for these things.
It is a collaborative attempt, and there may well be more partners in it. But I think the UK is quite determined. As I mentioned to you before, sovereign capability is very, very crucial to the UK. Maintaining it is very crucial to the UK. It's also important that we don't ignore the export capability here. Type 26 has been a perfect example of where we've seen we may not be making them in the UK, but Australia is building. And in this case, it's BAE Systems in Australia that will be building them, and Canada's taken the same design as well. So there's an involvement over there. So that's a great example of something that we can design, and then they can have a variant of it. They can do what they want to it in terms of additional design or change. But the UK is very, very good at this sort of thing, and we need to ensure that we maintain that. The companies we've got here, some of the service companies are questionable, but I think in terms of manufacturing, we are absolutely and utterly brilliant. And by manufacturing, I'm talking about ship making, submarine making, and indeed aero engine making. Rolls-Royce makes the military engines for Typhoon, has a big involvement in Tempest. And Tempest is very, very important to showing the rest of the world that we are there, we are able to do this, and I think it will be a great success. It's a long way off yet, but I think it'll be a great success.
Lots of interesting stuff there. Howard certainly knows his stuff. The big question for investors, though, is how all this translates into investment opportunities, which is something you've talked to Alex Janu about. Let's have a listen.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
I'm very well, Nilishi. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So, you wrote a feature last year about the defence sector. It's called Get Defensive, and I recommend everyone go and read it because it's really great. While the landscape has seen some changes since then, you picked up on some key trends in that feature that seem like they might be turbocharged in a post-COVID world. One of them was about the future of warfare and this kind of shift away from conventional battles. I was wondering if I could just get your take on what do you think are some of the key growth areas and what companies might sort of benefit from this shift?
Yeah, so I think if we step back and we look at the way that certainly in the UK we're addressing defence, much has been made of the Prime Minister's chief advisor, Dominic Cummings, and his approach to defence. There's been a lot of interesting media reporting on the abandonment of real cut legacy elements of our defence capability. So units like the Parachute Regiment and the Royal Marines are being talked about being cut down. Principally because, you know, when was the last time we jumped into battle or conducted a beach raid? These are symbols, and kind of a lot of people view these as symbols of projecting power, but in terms of modern warfare, they're not really seen as relevant anymore. In terms of where we're heading, well, cyber is the obvious one, and BAE Systems in particular are very hot, I know, on the cyber warfare space. Even looking in the current climate with coronavirus, the UK are 95% sure that Russia attempted a hack of coronavirus vaccine research on the UK, US and Canada. That really stresses the importance of having a strong cyber defence capability. coronavirus vaccine may well end up being the most valuable commodity in the world, and we won't really be able to defend it with tanks and the more kind of conventional warfare apparatus that we're used to. Drones, similarly, again, kind of reducing the need to put humans on the battlefield. Drones, I think, really came to the forefront of the public conscience with the Gatwick airport scandal a couple of years ago. God, that feels like a long time ago. And the company there to look at is Cohort. Cohort are a kind of defense tech company. They acquired a business called Chess a couple of years ago, who later claimed success in terms of dealing with that problem. And I guess nuclear support, you know, nuclear, the role of nuclear is not something that's been discussed, you know, that frequently, but it remains, I think, in a key and essential part of the UK's defence and the UK maintaining its presence on the national stage. And obviously, there's a lot of cooperation with the US, which is, you know, the world's biggest defence market in these areas. The other one, which I'd touch on actually as well, in that space, you'll remember, again, a few years ago, President Donald Trump, I think, was derided with the launch of the US Space Force. But actually, again, we've seen potential breakouts of conflict in space. I think Russia, again, has been accused of launching a missile or testing a missile in space. And look at the value of technology and how much of our infrastructure depends on tech in space. So obviously protecting that area is key. So that, you know, that's where we'll, I think, see earnings growth come from in the future. Again, BAE Systems are one for investors to look for in that respect. And in terms of looking away, well, you know, companies like Babcock, who, you know, we have, I know you're pretty bearish on Babcock as well. What kind of conventional warfare, the role of big battleships, and I'll just say, you know, a lot of defense companies will make a lot of, you know, we've put parts on this new car or tank and ship. And yes, companies like Babcock have fairly unique capabilities that give them what we call an economic moat, an advantage over other companies, but I really don't see much potential in the long term. And we'll come to the long term because this is, and it's important to look at this space with a long term investor perspective. Earnings aren't achieved in the short term here.
I think you're absolutely right. It's definitely about kind of the balance of equipment moving forward as well, because obviously the MOD is dealing with this massive shortfall. So they're under pressure about, you know, making sure they're spending efficiently, and they're moving towards these kind of more modern capabilities, and that has to come at the expense of something, i.e. kind of the conventional war aspect of things. That trade-off is actually something I spoke about with Professor Malcolm Chalmers, who's the Deputy Director of the Royal United Services Institute.
One of the big issues that's emerging is how far you invest in new technology, sometimes not entirely proven technology, providing the capabilities, the military capabilities that we expect we'll need in 2030 and beyond. And central to that debate is automation. How far you invest in new systems which rely less on people and rely on various forms of automation, up to virtually fully autonomous weapon systems, AI, increased role for cyber warfare, defensive and offensive, increased investment in space. There's a lot of talk about increased investment in space. You know, good example of that might be in terms of the next generation of combat aircraft. Right now, we have our Typhoon F-35 are the backbone of combat aircraft. But in future, if you're looking at 2030, 2035 and beyond, then I think it's likely a much higher proportion of the Air Force is going to be unmanned and fewer manned. And what's the balance there? Because you can save quite a lot of money if you take the pilot out of the system. An awful lot of money on the training budget, for example. And an awful lot of aircraft time right now is used to train the pilot rather than to be available for operations. So that's an area where there will be some difficult trade-offs, because if you invest a lot more in unmanned vessels or aircraft, or if you invest more in space and cyber with a budget that's more or less static in real terms, you have to take something out. You have to take out some existing older equipment on land, sea, and air, and maybe some older ships, for example. You probably have to make quite significant savings in personnel numbers to create the space for equipment investment. And how far do you go in that direction when some of those technologies are unproven? And also, I think, when they're understandably some strong constituencies defending existing weapon systems, existing ways of doing things. So it remains to be seen how radical they were. They will be in when the review comes out.
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, from my experience of covering defence, the departments tend to queue up, don't they? The Army will get their toys 1 year, the next year it'll be the Air Force, the next year it'll be the Navy. They do sort of, there's competition, but also an understanding of the way it works. And this is all being shaken up massively by this government. I mean, I touched on unmanned technologies in the form of drones, and another really interesting unmanned project is the Tempest fighter. I mean, the Eurofighter Typhoon, which is a kind of a joint, a symbol of cross countries, the project led by BAE Systems. We're seeing its successor being the Tempest fighter. That's BAE Systems, Leonardo, Rolls Royce. And I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of the earnings potential that investors might be able to generate via exposure to that project?
I think Tempest is really interesting. And I think the difficult thing for an investor's perspective is it's still in the very early stages. So it was launched in 2018. And I think so far the UK has invested about £2 billion in it, but it's obviously still in very early development stages. It's aiming to come into service by 2035, and it's meant to take over from the Typhoon. And like you mentioned, it's being headed up by BAE Systems and a consortium of other companies. So you've got the likes of Rolls-Royce, Kinetic, and GKN, which is owned by Melrose. One of the interesting things we're doing here is kind of this idea of joint development. So you spread the cost by bringing on other countries. So Italy has joined, and I think we're close to kind of getting Sweden to come on board as well. The idea of it is you kind of create a bigger market for it as well, so the whole project becomes more cost effective. It was interesting. I was talking to a defense analyst, Howard Wealdon, and he said, while it's good, you also have to remember that we need to retain sovereign capability as well. So something that's unique to us. You don't necessarily want to be developing something that's going to go to everyone.
Sure. And I guess another way of looking at this is in terms of the Typhoon, the controversy surrounding the UK and BAE Systems' relationship with Saudi Arabia, in that Saudi is BAE's, I think, third biggest customer. I mean, the way these contracts work with Saudi is that BAE will sell its products to the UK government, who will then sell them to Saudi. There are a lot has been made of Saudi Arabia's role in the Yemen conflict, for which they've used these Typhoon. And actually, Germany, which produces parts of the plane, simply refused to continue producing its parts. So obviously, that's really debilitating to a project that where you're crossing borders if parts of the kind of consortium aren't playing ball. So that is a real risk factor, I think. And in the point of sovereignty, I think you're absolutely right that it's important to be able to kind of retain these projects, complete control of these projects, and not be vulnerable to various political decisions made overseas. I think the UK government, in sort of temporary ban, while they reviewed that relationship, and now they've now removed that.
BAE is kind of such an interesting case study because the US is the biggest market. I think over 40% of their sales go to the US, but I think it's an even split actually between the UK and the Middle East. And when we say the Middle East, it's basically Saudi Arabia. Mm. And like you've kind of mentioned, that it really, more so than the kind of the other UK listed defense companies, that's the one that kind of draws the attention in terms of, ESG no-nos.
Yeah, definitely. When I covered this, and actually covered when that ban was imposed, looking around the defense sector, BAE are the only one now with serious exposure to the Middle East. I mean, it's seen as a huge market, but it does very much increase the ESG risk associated with BAE. And you only need to look at various allegations made by former engineers of BAE regarding practices and their involvement in the war there, which the company have in various sense denied. I think one other very interesting aspect of defence in the future is the role of special forces. So I touched on the abandonment of more kind of conventional land troops, but I think it's fair to say that special forces are being viewed as, again, a kind of growth opportunity. And the company that really, which I think you and I are both big fans of, Avon Rubber, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, so they do kind of special respiratory masks. The milk machines are gone, aren't they?
Yeah, they're selling the milk ones.
This is the great.
It was always such a random business. I know it was a legacy business, but it's great. It's like, we do masks and milk.
This is the great thing about interviewing Avon Rubin. You'd be talking about the SAS for 10 minutes with the chief executive, then you go, and now on to cows. But, but I mean, the really interesting thing there, they really, I touched on economic moats. Well, Avon Rubin make these respiratory masks for specialist divers. And they've told me in the past that there's only probably about 4,000 to 5,000 of these divers in the world. And so as a result, each mask costs $75,000 and calculates an addressable market, therefore, of $375 million, which doesn't sound like a big market, but when it's basically yours, that's fantastic. And the shares have done really well, Avon, and I think they'll continue to do well, particularly in the absence of milk.
Yeah, there's actually a graph in the news feature this week that shows the performance of these defense companies relative to the FTSE 350, and Avon Rubber has just completely outshone the rest of them.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's a company well worth paying the premium for.
Okay. Moving on to other things you kind of picked up in your defense feature from November, one of them was about the future of aerospace, and you looked at companies like Meggitt and Senior and Rolls-Royce. And you fast forward to now, and those companies just seem to be facing a completely different world right now. Give us a sense of what's changed in the whole aviation aerospace sector.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious just what's happened in terms of airlines and travel restrictions, compounding issues already. Certainly we saw with the grounded 737 MAX produced by Boeing. That was after two crashes. To find out more about the impact on the supply chain, I spoke to Dr. Steve Wright, who's a former Airbus engineer and a senior research fellow at the University of the West of England.
Steve, describe the toll this pandemic has taken on the civil aerospace supply chain.
Yes, well, clearly the immediate customer-facing organisations are having an absolute disaster, and we're seeing layoffs there already. I'm particularly thinking about the airlines, but then we see people a little bit further down the supply chain. So the first line support organisations, MROs as they're known, maintenance, repair and overhaul. So they'll be also starting to see a ripple. But the crucial thing to know about civil aerospace market, and this is both one of its strengths and its weaknesses, is nothing happens quickly. It's a huge end-to-end supply chain. So you've got the customer to airliner to airframer to vendor. So to put it in context, the development of a new aircraft can take typically about 8 years. So that provides a huge cushion to those people who are further down the supply chain. So the GE Aviation, so the Rolls-Royce to a lesser extent, things like that. But the people who are making the boxes, the materials that go on that, they're buffered slightly. But the flip side is also true, because the long-term pain will play out more slowly. So when I say pain, these are the things that sort of silently won't happen, the silent victims. So a good example of that was quite early on, I was expecting, here we go, some of the R&D projects, the research and development projects are going to start getting cut. And in fact, that started happening way sooner than I was expecting.
And what will falling airplane production volumes mean for suppliers?
Yeah, again, it's the same thing where there's this huge buffering effect within the market. Typically, the market has these huge backlogs. The numbers are usually in the thousands. So typically, the airliners are built, the airframers are booked out years in advance. And so they're very much hedged. In that sense, they've got this buffer. So we're all right for the time being. This isn't an existential threat to the industry, but we'll see a dip. So if you were investing, aerospace is what it's always been. It's been a relative blue chip in that you're playing a long game over a series of 5 to 10, even 20 years. But it's important to understand that it will ripple through slowly, but and similarly, the take-up at the end of it all will happen. In the short term, we're looking at about 2 years of serious pain. And I have to say, this is in my career in aerospace. I started in aerospace in 1989. And this is the fourth instance of this vast hit that's happened. The first one was in the early 90s, big recession then. The next one was the 9/11 fallout. Then there was the 2008 fallout. And now we've got the COVID hit as well. So this is number four for me. And this is far and away the biggest that I can see.
Mm. And we're witnessing trends in aerospace design, such as a shift towards more narrow-bodied aircraft. I mean, what will that mean to suppliers?
Now, this is the most interesting question of all. This is the one I love answering. It's where it gets really interesting, because this is where you get an opportunity to take a step back and think about how the market works already. The wide-body market is pretty much a duopoly between Boeing and Airbus worldwide. And that's because of these absolutely eye-watering numbers it takes to develop a new aircraft. And so the interesting thing about the narrow-body market is that it's usually the entry point for anybody who wants to try and take on the duopoly, as I think of it, capital T, capital D, head on. And it's interesting, in the last few years, the Canadians have tried it, and the Brazilians have tried it, probably aware of Canadair and Embraer from Brazil. And they've both had a go and frankly been seen off the market by the duopoly, which only shows how colossal the costs are, where even getting into the narrow-body market is really, really expensive. So the big question here, in my mind, is the Chinese. So if you want to do some Googling, go and look up a thing called the COMAC C919. If you Google that, you'll see it looks uncannily like an A320 or a Boeing 737. And that's not surprising. It's not a case of industrial espionage or anything. It's, you know, it's the same shape, because for the same reason that a fish and a dolphin are the same shape. It's driven by the physics. And technologically, this aircraft isn't really very interesting. It's almost a 1980s technology of the airframe and a load of reused Western vendor parts. But here's the thing. COMAC have been having huge technical and certification issues driving this C919 through. And I can't help thinking that if this was a Western project, a Western-based project, they would have pulled the plug by now. But the Chinese have got the political will and the financial backing to take this on as a national and global level project. And so they'll see it through. And this could be the opportunity for them to start getting headway into that market. So it's a really interesting, it could be the thing that breaks open the duopoly, which has been going for about 30 years now. So the thing to think about is, if we think of COMAC as a threat to the market in terms of change, think about they're pretty much where Airbus was in the 1970s. And so if you think about that, you only have to know what happened to McDonnell Douglas. They got driven out of the market. And so the duopoly, ironically, was reestablished. But whether there could be a three-way split in the market in the future is a really, really interesting question from an investment point of view.
One of the things that Dr. Wright mentioned was that there's sort of this buffering or sort of delayed impact, if down the supply chain. Is that what we're actually seeing with companies right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy for all of us to look at what's earnings figures and the parlous state of the aviation industry, panic and sell. I mean, Dr. Steve Wright obviously talks about the long-term investment sense, and I think that's reasonable. I mean, one company that I've looked at in great detail recently is Bodycote. Now, Bodycote produce thermal processing services, both for the aerospace and automotive markets, the last of which has obviously been in like a longer structural long-term decline. But they produce parts for engines, including the 737 MAX. They have, however, said that the shift in narrow-bodied engines does play to their strength. They've got more parts per engine and greater sort of value of revenue per engine. But I mean, for me personally, I think Bodycote's recovery still looks a long way away. You've touched on Senior in recent days, haven't you, Nalushi?
Yeah, I mean, Senior, I think 75% of its sales come from aerospace. And it's actually an interesting contrast. If you take the defense companies that have done well, it's because their defense has done well in spite of kind of commercial aerospace. When you take Senior, because it's got relatively less exposure to defense, that defense hasn't been able to rescue it from this downturn that we're seeing in civil aerospace. And to pick up on what you said kind of about the different aircraft, it's because I'm guessing that the wide-body aircraft are more to do with this long-haul travel, which is expected to take longer to recover than kind of these short-haul domestic flights.
Yeah, and so, you know, airlines are looking to bring in narrow-bodied aircraft. They're more efficient. They last longer. Look for, in terms of Airbus, the A321, the A320, and for Boeing is the 737 MAX, which was really heralded as a wonder plane. And it's so sad what's happened there. Obviously, the most tragic point being the crashes, but also in terms of the potential here for airlines. I mean, Ryanair succeeded in deferring their delivery, some of their 737 MAXs, and again, obviously adds to the ESG credentials both of the airlines and the manufacturers.
It was interesting from Boeing's earnings, their chief executive, Dave Calhoun, he actually said that they're basically getting a customer ringing them up each day and, you know, delaying or deferring an order. That's kind of the state of the industry right now. And I mean, once it hits Boeing, it then feeds down to through the entire supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, I looked to it at IAG, who reported a couple of weeks ago. They were talking about a recovery in passenger numbers to 2023, which is, that's been mirrored across by other airlines. But IATA, who are the trade body, have said it actually just go back to 2024. Visibility is incredibly difficult right now. I guess one thing to add is that while we're seeing perhaps a more fragmented approach to dealing with opening up the economy during coronavirus, hospitality, etc., it seems quite hard to me to open that. I think airlines, aviation, and tourism, that looks like a nationally controlled, well, an internationally controlled, really, kind of phenomenon. So it's going to be a lot harder to restore aviation, and it's going to be very, very difficult, particularly with the possible outbreak of a second wave of coronavirus.
It does kind of seem right now anyway that we are looking at a multi-year downturn. Even for the airlines, are there any sort of players here, or are they all just sales right now?
We quite like Ryanair. Ryanair pretty well capitalized, and I think low budget is the way to look. I mean, just anecdotally, I've seen people flying to some near destinations in Europe, whereas long-haul flights look a long way off, and particularly destinations like the US and Brazil look pretty unfeasible. So IAG, that kind of rules them out. And also, we obviously seen that Virgin Atlantic have filed for bankruptcy. So while, you know, airline shares were doing well in recent days off the back of the news from EasyJet and the recovery in their capacity, there is felt, you know, it's not looking great. Although that said, Virgin are direct competitor of IAG, so maybe that's good for them.
I mean, a rather tenuous link to pick up on from Virgin is Virgin Galactic, and they're doing a new partnership with Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce just isn't in a good place at all right now. I mean, Dr. Wright, he spoke about kind of this buffering effect, but for Rolls-Royce, it's much more of an immediate impact because a lot of their revenue relies on engine flying hours. So basically, they make these engines at a loss, and the idea is that they collect the revenue over the life of the engine to kind of make up for that. So as soon as these planes were grounded, that immediately fed into Rolls-Royce's earnings and cash flow.
Yeah, so, yeah, the aftermarket as well is so important. The spare parts and the maintenance is just so important to them. And they've had their own engine problems as well in recent parts due to blade deterioration. So we have to look beyond coronavirus and just think this is a company that's been a bad way for a long time now.
I think the interesting thing about Rolls-Royce is it really does kind of straddle both aerospace and defense. So kind of in terms of investment opportunities in the defense sector, how much do you think has kind of really changed since you last did your deep dive in November? Do we have to be looking at this slightly differently now? Do we have to go deeper into kind of the balance between aerospace and defense now?
Well, while it's correct, I think defense budgets will be under pressure. Those growth areas, I don't think, have really changed. Geopolitical landscape remains fragile. Don't forget, in January, we had Donald Trump ordering the killing of the Iranian general Soleimani. At one point, we looked like we were on the cusp of a world war. So I think that in terms of investment case, defense versus civil aerospace, defense, in my view, is a much safer investment sphere, carries long lead times. If your investment objectives are for the next 3 to 5 years, probably look elsewhere. But defense carries really long lead times, are quite secure, quite secure orders, long visibility. companies we've touched on, BAE, Cohort, Avon Rubber for me, certainly the latter two are good prospects. In terms of civil aviation, it's just there's so much, you know, pardon the pun, so much up in the air, both from the airline perspective and the suppliers. It's a really, really difficult place to be right now, and it's hard to really find any candidates, certainly among the airlines, that would make good investment prospects.
Well, thank you, Alex, for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on, Nalushi.
Thanks for that, Nalushi. A really interesting conversation with Alex, and actually with all your guests. One thing that hasn't been touched on yet is the current outlook based on geopolitical tensions. There are a few areas of the world that aren't in the midst of some sort of trauma. We probably shouldn't get John started on conspiracy theories. But what does this heightened tension mean for the outlook for defence?
I mean, it's all very well on the one hand to try and argue that you don't have the money for defence right now with everything else that's going on. But you have to place that in the context of a threat environment. If anything, the world's become more dangerous since the onset of this pandemic. So if you look at before, it was bad enough with US-China trade war tensions. And we look to be heading towards some kind of detente in that area. But the tit-for-tat rhetoric has increased. You've got everything that's going on with Huawei. Hong Kong came along. You've got the Uyghur situation in Xinjiang. Now the TikTok controversy. And on top of that, China's sphere of influence, particularly in Asia, but across the world, if you like, is increasing, and that's making the West rather uncomfortable. The South China Sea is becoming increasingly tense as different actors, including China, are vying for ownership of various different islands there. And that's actually potentially a source for hot conflict, you know, actual war in that region. And then you've got an increasingly emboldened Russia. I mean, I think Alex mentioned that they've been accused of launching a weapon in space. So there's two fronts here now. And, I mean, stepping even further back, you've got the changing role of the US as well. We're all used to the US kind of being the world's policeman. But under Donald Trump, they've kind of retreated from that role as the global guarantor of security. And that leaves its allies with a dilemma. I mean, particularly NATO. You just take what happened recently with Donald Trump announcing that they're going to withdraw 12,000 troops from Germany and also move their European headquarters away. I mean, really, that's not a move to make NATO more secure. That's more sort of a petty move on Trump's part with his kind of ongoing feud with Angela Merkel and his sort of bugbear about NATO spending, keeping that commitment of 2% of GDP. But I mean, what kind of message does that move send to countries typically reliant on the US for protection? At the same time, what kind of message does it send to Russia? And even if, you know, some people are banking on Joe Biden getting elected and the situation changing, but I don't think it really does, because I think this has caused sort of permanent harm, if you like, to the relations between the US and its allies. It sent a message that we can't fully rely on the US anymore, so it's not going to be back to business as usual. So those people considering making cuts will also have at the back or even the front of their mind that actually we've got to consider this a little more carefully because the situation has changed.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Germany because, you know, its failure to hit its 2% of GDP defence spending target has been a big bugbear, not just with the US, but with other countries as well, including the UK. You know, America's withdrawal there, I mean, perhaps this will encourage them to actually start hitting that 2% target if they are genuinely worried about the Russian threat.
I mean, you think it would. Obviously, things become more difficult. I mean, everyone's GDP is going to go down, so proportionally their defence spending is going to go down as well. But I think if they take the reasoning that, okay, we can't rely on the US as our sole protection anymore, that should motivate them to spend more on defence. And maybe indeed they will be getting close to that 2% target. Now, we actually hit that target ourselves, although there's some questions over that, because I think we also include pension spending as part of that, whereas other countries don't in their calculations.
I mean, there are other areas of conflict as well. I mean, you know, you mentioned the South China Sea, and China has been essentially building islands on atolls there for quite some time. This is something that's been talked about as a potential, sign of its increasing, you know, expansionist tendencies. But, you know, Taiwan is a potential flashpoint there. And China itself is, you know, very aggressive in its rhetoric towards Taiwan. And there must be genuine worries about what's going to happen there.
I mean, indeed. And also, you can kind of look at Hong Kong as a precursor to that. They'll be looking very closely at how, you know, Western allies have reacted to its moves in Hong Kong as to how far they can kind of push that envelope. We didn't really get much beyond, you know, strong rhetoric when it came to Hong Kong. So you have to kind of question whether the US and its allies are going to step up if they do something vis-a-vis Taiwan.
What about in India? You know, there's been some flare-ups on the border there. I mean, that was kind of new to me when I heard it, that China and India would be aggressive towards each other on their borders. What's behind that?
I mean, oh no, some people, you don't really pay attention to that. You typically think of, okay, India, Pakistan as the conflict going on in that region. And then, you know, you tend to go then out wider to the US, China and Russia as well. But that border is tense. And there was a serious flare up back in May. It's quietened down, but that's still a significant conflict that, if you like, you could argue it's waiting to happen.
I suppose if all these things are just waiting to happen, then yeah, it's not the right time to be making defence cuts anywhere.
I mean, absolutely not. That's why defence is a long-term game, both in terms of investment, but in terms of, you know, defence planning as well. You cut for now, and who knows, you know, next year, 5 years' time, you could be involved in a conflict. And once you're in that conflict, you can't rectify, you know, spending that you should have made 5 years ago. So, I mean, defence planners will not take a short-term view. I guess it's more sort of how treasuries react to this and politicians.
Going back again to the actual investment angle on this, I suppose, with a lot of what industries involved in, they are bigger, more long-term projects than they are necessarily the kind of cuts that can be made to the short term, which is maybe reducing the size of the army, reducing the size of the navy, things like that. If for the private companies that are involved in it, it's a lot of them are big projects, aren't they?
Absolutely. And so I think some of them are a bit more secure. I mean, they'll be tightly written contracts and controls, so it's not like the MOD can just, you know, massively just slash through all these programs that they've committed to. There could be delays, however, and that could increase costs for some of the companies working on these programs. There are also the service companies, I suppose, who will be involved with things, you know, aspects of the personnel side, so they could see a nearer term hit. But overall, perhaps the kind of capital spending should remain in place, although it could be over an elongated period of time.
I used to cover defence some time ago, and, you know, looking back, my worry of that, some of those big sort of research-led projects, the big capital-intensive projects, is what they're investing in, you know, turn out to be white elephants by the time they actually get to their sort of operational start. You know, the Tempest programme isn't due to come into action until 2035, by which point everything could have changed again.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing with defence. You're making a bet on the future and a long time in the future as well. So we're hoping that, you know, Tempest is the way to go by the time it comes into service in 2035. I mean, who knows? But, I mean, the idea of, you know, completely unmanned stealth fighter jets is slightly terrifying, but that seems to be the way things are going.
You mentioned space earlier, and you and Alex spoke about, you know, the rumours of Russia building a space weapon. You know, space seems to be gaining a lot more interest than it has in the past. I think Elon Musk sent someone up into space very recently. But you know, a lot of countries are looking to the skies now. What's going on there?
I mean, it seems crazy if you suggest the idea of a space war. I mean, I think Alex pointed out as well, everyone kind of laughed when Donald Trump came up with his space force. And even now, I tend to think of the Netflix series rather than an actual space fighting force. But it genuinely could be the way that things are going. Space is very important. It's important to all of us. I mean, we've all got our satellites up there. And if you think how devastating a space war could be, if you knock out those satellites, you essentially knock out global technology.
Yes.
So, I mean, you don't just want the fighting capability. You want the ability to kind of protect your assets up in space as well.
That Netflix program, I think, is the timing of it's crazy because when they were producing it, they must have, I mean, it's been produced as a bit of a joke, hasn't it? But actually, it's pretty timely if wars in space are starting to be an actual, could be a potential thing. They've nailed their timing with that.
Science fiction is often a very good guide to what's actually going to happen.
Back to the future is
not conspiracy theories, I hasten to add.
Absolutely. I just hope that what the Americans have got going on behind the scenes are slightly less incompetent than Steve Carell was in that program.
Who knows? Well, thanks, Nalushi. This is a really great series of interviews that you've put together. It's really, really interesting, and hopefully some good investment insight as well. Thanks for putting it together.
Thank you.
That's unfortunately it for this week, but before we sign off, let me talk you through what else we've got in this week's magazine. First up, I have to mention the new dedicated property section that we've introduced this week with some very timely insights from our property editor, Emma Powell, given the huge shake-up of planning law the government has announced today. Results are back with a vengeance, with updates from many of the FTSE's biggest companies, AstraZeneca, Shell, HSBC and Diageo, among the 40-odd results write-ups. It's fair to say it's a very mixed picture of COVID winners and losers, although the good news is that we are seeing the resumption of some dividends. In the PF and funds section, Rosie Carr has put together a tour de force on the complex business of managing the pension's lifetime allowance, while Mary McDougall has taken a deep dive into Polar Capital Technology Trust to understand its strategy and the companies it holds. Mary's also done a great podcast with its manager, Ben Rogov, which you can hear via our podcast stream, along with Lauren Almeida's interview with Walter Price of the Allianz Technology Trust. It's an interesting contrast. On top of that, we have John Barron's latest investment trust update, along with all the usual comments, tips, educational features and news, including our thoughts on BP's surprise dividend cut. And finally, there is the main feature this week, in which our economist, Chris Dello, asks, what do the Beatles, riots and fish markets have to do with the stock market? The answer is that they all help illustrate a new economic theory of complexity, which could help explain why markets crash. Thanks to Nalushi for putting this podcast together, and to all of our guests, Howard Wheeldon, Malcolm Chalmers, Steve Wright, and our own Alex Janot. And thanks, as always, to my excellent co-host, Megan. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next week when we'll be taking a good look at the investment platform market. In the meantime, take care. See you soon.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.